Namaste and welcome to the Bharatvartha podcast. I'm Roshan Karyapa. We've spoken about media bias and how international reporting is skewed against India. You may recall our episodes with Ruchir Sharma and Vishal Ganeshan, where we covered plenty of related nuances. Today, we're going to be speaking to a very special guest, Ashley Rinsberg, who is the author of The Grey Lady Winked, How the New York Times is Misreporting, Distortions and Fabrications Radically Alter History. It's a provocative title, but the book is backed by a lot of meticulous research and has been receiving favorable reviews. So in this conversation, we hope to understand more about Ashley's work and also uncover the roots of this misreporting and bias against India. So without further ado, welcome, Ashley. Thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you so much, Roshan.
So Ashley, let's start with a bit of background. As I understand, you were born in South Africa, moved to the States, mm-hmm. traveled a fair bit, and then are now based out of Tel Aviv in Israel. Mm-hmm. How did you get to writing this book and what was that process like?
Yeah, the book really came out of this curiosity for me, which is to understand if what we're being told is true. And for me, this start, you know, I think this is very popular and very common today in obviously around the world now, but for me, it started a bit earlier. And I was really interested in this topic around 2004, 2005. And I came across a footnote in a work of history by William Shirer, which is The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, where he kind of mentions casually that the New York Times reported on September 1st, 1939, which was the outbreak of hostilities in Europe in World War II, that Poland had invaded Germany, and in its lead story from that day, and that the Germans were retaliating, sort of just, you know, responding. And obviously this was a lie. It was a Nazi propaganda ploy. And with its publication as the lead story of the New York Times of that day, it was a great success. So I wanted to understand why this happened and how it happened and what else happened in this similar vein. How was the New York Times shaping or misshaping history and in sort of world-changing historical events? Also to really understand why it would do things like this. And that's where The Grey Lady Winked.
You know, it's fitting for the times that we live in, right? I mean, we're living in a time when there's very high distrust in anything institutional, right? And media is at the top of the heap, I would say, on that in that regard. But it's also rare to find someone who speaks out against this, right? Because the cost of speaking out is significant. I mean, as we've seen with the kind of cancel culture that's prevailing. So what really forced you to take this up more seriously and actually publish a book?
Yeah, well, when I initially wrote the book, it was ignored. I mean, people told me to my face that they couldn't risk angering the New York Times. These were top level literary agents, editors, and I didn't publish it. There was no avenue for me to do so. And more recently, last year and the year before that, when I was really thinking about publishing it and then published it, it was just so clear that there was something going on here that was really getting to a lot of people. And it really centered around the New York Times, at least in the US. And that's because the New York Times plays such a special role in the American news media, in journalism, and in just the broader media, this culture of ideas and trends and influences. It sits at the center. And I kept seeing these stories break about the New York Times nurturing this culture of intimidation and harassment that was really skewed towards woke ideologies that forced one of their key writers to resign. Stories like that where I was kind of screaming at my phone or my computer screen that you don't know the half of it. You don't know. People think that this is sort of a recent turn at the New York Times. What I understood through writing and researching the book was that this goes way, way back. I mean, I trace it at least a century or just about to the early 1930s or even before that, the mid and late 1920s when they were dealing with Hitler. And so I wanted people to understand that everything they really had assumed about the New York Times and the media, which is that this is all just recent developments, this is sort of like novel stuff, was not quite true. It's partly true, but because it has been accentuated and it's gotten emphasized by certain trends like social media in recent years. But this is really part and parcel of the way the American news media is incentivized and structured.
Yeah, I think for most of us, we've seen the shoddy reporting over the last year and a half on the coronavirus pandemic, right? Where somehow they refused to acknowledge that it could have originated from a lab, even in theory, right? I mean, they didn't want to give credence to that. A few of us may again go back to the Iraq war as well on weapons of mass destruction and so on. But you go way back, right? I mean, you go 90, 100 years back and you talk about, the editor of the New York Times being an active Nazi collaborator, how they covered up the Ukraine famine, for example, and so on. So, can you talk us through some of those famous instances that may not be in public memory, but the New York Times had taken up this sort of a contrarian position to the truth in some sense?
Yeah, well, in the terms of the Nazi reporting, the reporting that was coming out of Germany in the mid to late 20s about Hitler specifically, where they were reassuring New York Times readers that this was just kind of this guy wasn't that bad. And like, he was just going to go retire to Bavaria once he got out of prison, and, calling him a patriot. One article about him said that he was actuated by a lofty and unselfish patriotism, where you think to yourself, whoa, like that's, I mean, how bad can you get of a description of a historical figure? And that sort of was the very beginning of the pattern at the New York Times that stretched at least 10 years, probably much longer, probably 15 years, right up through what I mentioned regarding the outbreak of hostilities in World War II, where the New York Times was consistently publishing news articles, major stories that were very favorable to the Nazis. And they did this because their Berlin bureau chief was a Nazi sympathizer, or I tend to think of him as a Nazi collaborator. He actually worked with the Nazis. All the American reporters were rounded up by the German authorities after the outbreak of war. He was the one reporter, the one American reporter and the one Western reporter that was actually not put into this sort of temporary prison. He was allowed to stay in his luxury hotel in Berlin because he was working so hand in glove with the Nazi brass in his reporting. And the New York Times knew this. They were made aware of it by a mid-level editor, a Jewish editor, who came to them and said, this cannot persist. We cannot have a Nazi collaborator running the most important bureau in the world at the time. And they threatened that editor with a libel lawsuit. They threatened to sue him and to fire him, of course. And the reason was because this editor, the Berlin bureau chief, Guido Enderes, was bringing home the goods. He was bringing great scoops because the Nazis were just funneling him information because he printed the stories that the way they wanted to see them. And they didn't want to risk that competitive edge. They wanted to stay number one. This was a business decision more than anything else. And that's sort of the through line that you see, whereas their agenda is very much about advancing their own interests, whether that's about power or money. In some cases, it's about ideology, but usually it's about power and money. And that's something that we're seeing today in certain ways, probably with their coronavirus reporting, which was very soft on China. They were sort of walking on eggshells with regard to this claim that the coronavirus might have emerged from the lab in Wuhan. China, for them, is a major venue for investment. They're looking to open operations, New York Times Chinese edition, and get access to that gigantic market. And they didn't want to offend the CCP, is my theory. And that's the same case when we looked at the most infamous of all New York Times reporters, who is Walter Duranty, who covered up the Ukraine famine, which was an effort led by Stalin to consolidate power by creating a famine in Ukraine. This was an act of genocide. And Walter Duranty was the New York Times Russia correspondent in the early 1930s, covered it up. He denied it. He said there was no such thing as a famine. He, in fact, knew that there was a famine. He knew why it was happening. He knew the scale of it. And in his reporting, he not only denied the existence of a famine, he denied the reporting of other journalists who claimed that there was. And again, this goes back to a financial interest that the New York Times had in order to help business concerns that it was aligned with in New York get access to the Russian market, to the new Soviet market, which is a gigantic market. It was industrializing very quickly. And the New York Times was part of a sort of consortium of businesses, of huge businesses. We're not talking about mid-level. We're talking about the very biggest businesses in the US that wanted to start trade relations with the USSR as soon as possible. And you couldn't do that if the world knew that, or at least the American public believed that this same government had just murdered 5 million of its own people.
The World War II coverage is especially egregious, right? Considering that the Sulzberger family that owns the New York Times is actually Jewish.
Yes, at the time they were. They are no longer Jewish. They've either converted or married out. But they were Jewish at the time. And that coincided with their coverage of the Holocaust, which was pretty much non-existent. They deliberately downplayed the Holocaust. They published 6 front page stories about the Holocaust in 6 years. They would have a story about the murder of 600,000 deaths of Jews. The murder of 600,000 Jews in Europe, and they would put it in the back of the newspaper, page A12, while on the same day's edition, they would publish on the front page a story about the death of a single individual in Iceland. Again, you have to say, why? Just say, why do this? This is the story of a generation, not just a lifetime. This comes back to their business interest. They didn't want to be seen as a Jewish newspaper in an increasingly anti-Semitic cultural environment in the US, especially in New York City in that period. And in order to not be seen as a Jewish newspaper, they covered up the biggest Jewish story of the 20th century easily, and probably much more than that.
Yeah. So how much power does the New York Times, wield, right? I mean, we could make the case that, it's obviously losing power in the era of social media and decentralization as such, right? But what is the impact of, all of this fabricating and propagating counter narratives and so on, right? What do you think has been the real impact of all of this?
I think what you see from the Gray Lady Winked is that the impact is very real historically. They sent a correspondent to Cuba in the late 1950s to find an irrelevant and all but forgotten rebel named Fidel Castro. Their front page reporting that they published multiple times over the course of the next month made Fidel Castro into a superstar. They revived him. They resurrected him. They all but implanted him as the dictator of Cuba. And, we see that's a trend that occurs over and over and over. And if we fast forward to today, till 2019, when they published the 1619 Project, which was an effort to reframe American history from one that's rooted in liberty to one rooted in slavery. We are seeing all around the country, in America and all around the world, this new narrative of America being sort of this remnant of a slaveocracy where slavery is still continuing to this day. And I just watched a video by a former NFL player, a football player in America, claiming that men like him who play for this football league, American Football League, making tens of millions of dollars a year are slaves. And that's a narrative that comes from the New York Times as much as from anywhere else. And it's something that they are doing intentionally. And it's because they are at the very center of a media ecosystem that includes things like the Pulitzer Prize, that includes Netflix, which is making a series based on New York Times reporting. Oprah Winfrey, who is producing a TV and film production based on the 1619 Project. So they are instrumental to this cultural media ecosystem that is very corporate, and it gives them a tremendous amount of power. So maybe they don't have the same kind of hard power that they had in the 1950s and 60s when they had many more readers proportionally, but they still do have this enormous lever that is the media industrial complex of America.
Right. So does it all boil down to, perverse business incentives, or is the New York Times trying to protect the interests of, protect some kind of a vested interest in all of this?
It's both. I think it's first and foremost, it's money and power. The New York Times is owned by a family, the family that we were discussing before, the Sulzbergers. They are a dynasty. They hand down control of the newspaper and the company that owns the newspaper from male heir to male heir. It's a literal patriarchy. And like all dynasties, they are really vested in maintaining the power and the wealth of the dynasty. That to me is probably the overriding factor for them. But that doesn't mean there are not ideological considerations as well that really weigh heavily on the New York Times. There is absolutely a worldview at the New York Times that they do not like to see challenged. And I think that's a lot of where the India reporting and the obvious bias or the obvious agenda, I would say, that's at work in the India reporting, it stems from that worldview, which is a worldview which in a lot of senses believes that pluralism cannot walk hand in hand with nationalism, that there's no such thing. And that's something that we've seen, since post-Holocaust era, where they look at the Holocaust and they say, okay, look what nationalism did to Europe. Therefore, any form of nationalism is evil, and it is absolutely at odds with pluralism. And India, much like Israel, disproves that theory. You look at India, you look at Israel, and you look at other countries around the world where nationalist trends or a nationalist model does actually gel with a pluralistic society where there are equal rights available to different people, despite there being a national identity that's at work in the country. And I think this is something the New York Times hates to see, because it really undermines a lot of the worldview that sort of motivates their reporting and shapes their reporting, and the individuals that are doing that reporting as well, who harbor that view.
Yeah, I think India's pluralism is steeped in our culture itself, right? Of 5,000 plus years. You know, in your recent interviews, you also mentioned that NYT's coverage of India was, to quote, almost orientalist, and you called out a few of these almost racist headlines that they put out, right? Including, you know, why India's farmers fight to save a broken system, under Modi, a Hindu nationalist surge has further divided India, what the rape and murder of a child reveals about Modi's India, and so on and so forth. Could you elaborate a little more about this and go into perhaps, you know, the reasons behind this sort of a propaganda, I would say?
I think that what we're seeing with the coverage is editorial decision-making, because you could cover many of these things in different ways, and you could give them different headlines, and you could shape the stories in any number of ways. That's sort of the beauty and also the pitfall of journalism, is that it's not just data, it's someone actually shaping the story. So when you see a collection of headlines that read like the ones you just read out, and they all show the same pattern, that to me is a red flag that there is a narrative being built, narrative being constructed and enforced. And that to me is another red flag saying something here is wrong, because there should never be a narrative being forced, being promoted by any journalistic outlet. That's not the job of journalism. Journalism should be gathering the facts, bringing whatever truth might be there, not especially in this day and age, trying to push this idea that India is this or that kind of country. And, you know, one thing that really caught my eye early on in my research about India was a quote that had to do with, again, this is a quote from the New York Times, India's rampant sexual abuse culture, culture of rape, something like that. I used the word ridiculous. Rampant. Yeah. And I, you know, this is something that was absorbed through the media, that there was this problem of sexual crime or sexual abuse or whatever the New York Times characterized it as. But then with this research, I actually started to look at the data, the statistics. And the statistics make a complete joke of that claim, because they show that India has a fraction of of sexual crimes that we see in just about all of the West, and certainly in the US. And you have to say, well, how can they even make a claim that sexual violence is rampant in India when it's a fraction of what it is in the US? Where does that even come from if it doesn't come from the data? And you could say, well, maybe the reporter thinks that the data has been contaminated by bias, or that they're not reporting true numbers, but that still doesn't mean that there's any other data showing it's true. What we're seeing there is a reporter who's just making a claim. He's just putting it out there into the universe and seeing if it'll stick. And when you do that enough times, eventually it does stick. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing with India, where India is characterized today, especially with coronavirus response, by death pyres and alongside the sexual violence reporting, rape. And that's what the reporting is. And when you look at the New York Times' reporting on China from the same period, where in August 2020, they did this huge piece about how China had conquered coronavirus and there were parties going on in Wuhan, which I'm sure were staged by the CCP. Then you say to yourself, why is there this discrepancy? Why is there a gap? What is it about these two places that motivates such a different response? While China, as we know, is carrying out a genocide against an ethnic minority. Why hasn't that made itself into the top line reporting of the New York Times for the past 2 years? Well, and again, the same period, we're seeing India rape, death, and backwardness. And that's where this notion of it being orientalist comes from, because it's preaching a worldview by telling an improper story, by telling a false story about this country. It is preaching a Western view of this place and how it ought to be that has nothing to do with the realities on the ground.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think you're 100% spot on in that, right? I mean, an editorial view is also what you choose not to report on, right? As much as, you know, what you actually say.
Yes.
And also what part of the data you look at in context, because, you know, this rape culture thing, for example, I mean, it was just absolutely absurd, because anybody who compared, you know, rape in Delhi versus New York or elsewhere would realize that obviously, I mean, you know, proportionately Delhi had less, right? You know, for all of the ills that they talk about India, India is famously short of state capacity, right? I mean, whether it's police or judiciary or anything. So if India was really, you know, all of that, such a mess that, you know, the New York Times thinks it is, we would have crumbled a long time ago. It also is very weird that, you know, I mean, nothing can be all good or bad, right? I mean, really, because I'm yet to see anything positive come out of, you know, NYT or even the others, Washington Post or so on over the last 7-8 years. You know, maybe because there isn't a political dispensation that you favor, simply every story cannot be painted with a very broad brush of, okay, everything is bad here, right? You know, I want to ask a related question on objective journalism, right? I mean, NYT often, you know, positions itself as the beacon of truth, right? They don't say that they're writing stories or, you know, they're even taking an editorial stance on any of these things, unless, I mean, of course, it's some, you know, obvious sort of a virtue signaling thing, right? I mean, against poverty or hunger or whatever else. Is there such a thing as objective journalism or, you know, people, do you expect people to just come out there out in the open and just say that, hey, you know what, this is our bias and, you know, take what you will out of this?
I think that there is a difference between bias and having an agenda. And bias becomes sort of this straw man argument in journalism where you say, well, you know, there's bias and the other side says, well, of course there's bias. We're human beings, we're not robots. And that's just the nature of life. And that's true. I actually agree with that. And I think it's okay to bring bias when we think about bias as just the filter that everybody sees the world through, the filter of your experiences, your knowledge, your values, whatever. That's just being a human being and it's okay. But having an agenda is a completely different thing. That means you will push your interests at almost any cost. And that's the problem. That's what we're seeing today across the US media, the mainstream media, and certainly at the New York Times, that's been going on for a very long time. And, you know, I think a great example of this that is in The Gray Lady Winked has to do with the US dropping of the atomic bomb in Japan, where they made a deal with the American Department of War to allow the Department of War to basically publish propaganda in the New York Times concerning the nuclear weapon. And in return, the New York Times would get to have the only journalist or the only actually non-military person on one of the bombing runs that bombed Nagasaki. And the exchange was made. And what the New York Times did was publish this line that the atomic weapons produced no such thing as radiation poisoning. It was a myth, according to the Times. And at the same time, journalists from around the world were on the ground, including actually one New York Times journalist who had the guts to go there and report. And they said they could see from their own eyes that there was radiation poisoning, of course. And the New York Times knew this. Their chief science reporter was a brilliant man. He absolutely would have known this to be the case, but they ran it anyway because there was an agenda. And the agenda was, okay, let's be the number one news outlet on this huge story. This is one of the biggest stories of, you know, the modern era, the dropping of an atomic weapon on a city. And in exchange, we'll make the sacrifice that we'll have to make, meaning the truth. And that's such a poignant example of how this works. I mean, it's like, it's really distilled and pure. And that's why it's such a great example in the book for all the other types of reporting the New York Times has done with an agenda that's a little bit more murky, where you could say New York Times could point to India or to Israel and say, well, these things are actually happening. And that's the reason why we're reporting it. And it's hard to argue against that if you don't really come armed with a lot of background, a lot of facts, a lot of evidence. But when you look at how they use their agenda, use the truth to advance an agenda, you see that that's exactly what's at work. And you ask the question, why would the New York Times care about which way things fall in India? To say, you know, why would they even bother to push a narrative? And again, there's an agenda at work. And we see that the mechanisms of that agenda are very clear cut when you really pull back the curtain.
Right. There also seems to be some colonial undertones to the reporting as well, right? Because oftentimes, I mean, when you look at these headlines or even these stories, I mean, they tend to talk down to us Indians or, you know, there's a certain amount of condescension as well. And you found parallels between, you know, the coverage and also East India companies pre-independence, you know, some of the stuff that was being said then, right? Yeah, could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I don't remember who it was on Twitter, but someone came out with a comment. I think it was a professor from Stanford, a professor of medicine at Stanford, who's an Indian man. And he sort of put his finger on it by saying that it has these tones as if it was written, these reports by the New York Times were written by the East India Company, because it really does talk down to Indians as if the New York Times knows the country better than the people who actually live there. And that's a bit shocking. But to me, this is something that actually goes back quite a long ways. And part of my research, I uncovered the case of Sarah Bull, who was a 19th century heiress. She inherited a lot of money from her husband, and she became a devoted student of Swami Vivekananda and donated all of her money to him. And this was something that obviously her daughter, who didn't get any of the money, didn't like. And the New York Times joined in this campaign to vilify not just Swami Vivekananda, but all of Hinduism, which is quite insane. This was really what kicked off what a professor of comparative religion at Boston University, whose name is Stephen Prothero, called the quote unquote Hindu invasion. And he spells it with two O's to make the point. That's being that the New York Times had this spread this sort of anti-Hindu invective, calling Hinduism a psychic conspiracy, and that it was involved in mystic meditation rings, and going so far as to say that these people had actually poisoned the minds of people like Sarah Bull in America. So we this goes really back a long way. And you think that this kind of reporting almost gets in the DNA of the type of reporting they do on a particular place. And the same very much with Israel. They have been reporting the same way on Israel for not just 10 or 20 years, but for decades and decades, really going as far back as to the founding of the state of Israel. And it's something that becomes part of the cultural DNA of the media organization itself. And that's a bit scary, especially in this day and age, where you think, okay, we've seen all this sort of reckoning about race and how quote unquote white institutions in the US have treated various races or ethnicities. And why did this one go sort of unnoticed, that they did all this crazy reporting? Or another great example that's come out of my research and interactions on Twitter is that they conflated the swastika with the sacred Indian symbol with the German hooked cross. So until the New York Times said the German hooked cross is a swastika, no one had ever really called it a swastika, because that was something completely separate. It was completely different from what the Germans had. I mean, the German Nazis had co-opted the symbol, but the New York Times turned the German hooked cross into the quote unquote swastika. So these are things that really feel like we need to be revisiting, especially the New York Times, but they're not. And that's what's really worrying about it. They're leaning into the narrative rather than going back and looking at where they went wrong.
Yeah, so a friend of mine, Vishal Ganeshan, runs this handle called Hindu History on Twitter, where he curates the reporting from the 19th century onwards. And you see like a continuing thread in the type of reporting that happens typically on India, right? So Ashley, is there an element of foreign policy here? I mean, has the New York Times been co-opted by, you know, some of these governments to do their bidding? Do you think that is a possibility? I mean, is there some kind of a global geopolitical game of chess being played that, you know, we are somehow being, you know, unaware of?
I do think there is. I think there's absolutely the influence that is being exerted by powerful state actors. And this is something the New York Times actually has covered. Ben Smith, who's their media columnist, did a really big column a couple months ago about how China is leaning on all these small media outlets around the world and using its money as well to do so in order to influence coverage of the coronavirus in China. And Smith, when he wrote this column, never brought up the New York Times and how they might be affected by the same trend, obviously. I mean, it would be shocking if he actually had. But that to me is really the point, is that the New York Times itself knows that China, and China is probably the biggest example of this because they are the most powerful and the most aggressive, but they know that this is happening, but they're not really paying attention in their own pages to how it's affecting their own coverage. And you know, the CCP, the Communist Party of China, has been paying the New York Times tens of thousands. We don't actually know the number because it's not properly reported, and it actually should be according to American law. But CCP-owned outlets, including China Daily, have paid upwards of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. And what if you extrapolate it out, it looks more like millions of dollars to the New York Times, as well as other major media outlets, including the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and many others, to run Chinese propaganda on their newspapers. It has, you know, this small label saying it's sponsored content or whatever they call it, but it looks for all intents and purposes as if it's New York Times content or Washington Post content. And you think parallel to this, what other kinds of influence is being exerted on these newspapers in order to produce coverage that is favorable, in this case, to China or to the Biden administration or to whoever else might be able to influence coverage in that way. So I definitely think there is some kind of great game or equivalent of a great game being played out, instead of, you know, this being uncharted territory in the what we call the Far East. It's being played out on the newspapers of the American mainstream media.
Right. You've also written about the Times collecting a lot of user data as well for targeted advertisements and so on, right? And this is the kind of thing that the NYT actually, fights the big tech on, right? I mean, whether it's the likes of Facebook or whoever. Do you think, I mean, and I think, you know, Balaji Srinivasan likes to call this out that, you know, the NYT is in competition with Facebook and the likes, right? Mm-hmm. What do you make of that?
You know, I think that the Times has been very harsh, as the rest of the media has too, recently. It wasn't always this way, but recently, about how Facebook and other social media giants polarize content because it drives revenue. But when you look at the New York Times own model, which is now subscription-based, where it used to be advertising-based. So when it was advertising-based, every single one of your readers had roughly the same amount of value to the newspaper, because each view or each set of eyeballs looking at the newspaper helped them to sell ads. Today, their subscription-based model means that only about 2% of their entire readership is actually paying them. And what that means for their coverage is that they are naturally going to skew coverage to what motivates and incentivizes that 2% to continue paying for the coverage, which means the coverage is becoming more radicalized, more polarizing, and in some ways, part and parcel to that, more racialized, because that's really one of these animating issues in the US. So they have absolutely been doing the same thing that Facebook has been accused by them of doing. And I think that's, you know, part of the problem here, which is that they are polarizing news content in a way that's very damaging to, at least for American democracy, probably for other democracies around the world as well. And again, it's all about their business interests. It's all about the agenda. And that's why it's truly concerning.
You know, we've spoken a fair bit about the problems, with all of this. What do you see as an antidote to this? I mean, what should a layperson do to sort of like combat all of this?
I think it's a lot about having the conversation, exploring these ideas, being open-minded about the news sources, nevertheless, to say, okay, they might have a serious problem, but that doesn't mean there's not really good reporting coming out of some of these places, and to be respectful of that and not to throw out the baby with the bathwater. But I also think it's about really tailoring the kind of consumption that people are doing on a daily basis, because they want you to consume all of it. That's what's in the interest of these media organizations. They want you to just consume. But what's in your interest is to truly become an expert on the topics that you care about. So I would say take two or three topics, choose the two or three that are absolutely really important to you. And instead of browsing, instead of like this lean back approach to media consumption, where you're just sort of being force fed the information that they want you to have, go and search for the information that you want to have, that you can corroborate, that you identify as coming from trustworthy and reliable sources. So it's on us to be able to change our own modality of news consumption. And it's something that we can actually do really easily today, where we never could have done it before, because before you would just have one or two local newspapers. You're probably only going to subscribe to one of them. And that was that. Today, we have endless amount of information that we can choose from, but it's so much that you really do have to make a very intentional choice. You have to set that intention for yourself and say, this is what matters to me, and this is how I'm going to find the facts, corroborate them, and help spread what I believe to be the truth about the matter.
Right. Yeah, I think we have to be a lot more deliberate about what we consume, right? Because I think there's an impact beyond our own selves in terms of, you know, society, and you know, especially we've seen with this whole clickbait sort of a journalism, right? A case of incentives building up. How do you see the future of journalism evolve from here? I mean, one can argue that, you know, they never quite recovered from when digital media came about, right? And social media and so on. And now further with decentralization and things to that effect, we're seeing the model like literally break down, right?
I think there's going to be a major fracturing in the media, just as there has been in politics, at least in the US. If you look at the political outcomes of presidential elections in the United States in the 1940s or 50s or 60s, 70s or 80s, you see enormous blocks of voting that all went roughly the same way. And, you know, the electoral vote counts are just shocking compared to what they are today, because everyone went for one or the other candidate, generally speaking. And that's what media was as well. You would have CBS News or Walter Cronkite, where, you know, 90% of the country would be watching the same news broadcast. Today, that's obviously not the case. And I think that's going to accelerate. I think among the legacy news media or traditional news media, it will converge on two or three huge players that will be able to survive and to thrive, and probably really just one player. And the New York Times is setting itself up to be that one. And aside from that, we'll see a lot more independent media. We'll see new models of news media, like nonprofit, NGO, news organizations. And I think we'll see new formats that are better suited to meet the needs of today's news consumers, like podcasts, like video. So a lot more fracturing, a lot more diversity. And what I think is probably the best outcome is that this will all not be happening in the same space. That's where things get really rancorous, because it's all today happening on Twitter. It's all in the same place. You're seeing these people who are speaking different languages. I mean, they're using, let's say, English as the common language nominally, but they're actually using the terms in such different ways that they're incommensurate with one another. They're speaking past each other, and it's because they don't belong in the same room together. It's like there's if you imagine like a small auditorium overflowing with people, and we know what happens, a stampede happens. And that's what's happening today in digital media. This is just a stampede caused by polarized news content fed into these echo chambers of Twitter, Facebook, and the like. So I think we're going to see a lot more fragmentation, both in terms of the content and in terms of the format, where people will be able to sort of work within the same community. I think that's probably the best. I mean, there are also huge downsides to that, but I think it's probably better than what we have today, which is just these machines that fuel anger and divisiveness and hatred.
Right. And, you know, we reference the distrust that people have in media and institutions, right? So how should one, you know, go about trusting a news source, and how should one consume news actually? I mean, is it, you know, because obviously everyone will not have the time to sort of look at multiple sources and so on and so forth. And you also advised, you know, probably focusing on one or two things and going really deep on that, right? And subtracting a lot of the things that may not really matter. Because I mean, if I look at the last year's headlines, how many of those really like mattered in my life, right? And impacted me? I mean, not a lot, really. I mean, everything seems to be very transient and inflated. But yeah, I mean, to round things off, you know, how should one consume news?
I think we should consume news minimally. I think the more we sort of continue to exist in our physical environment, immediate physical environment, the better we will be, the happier and healthier we will be. And the less we consume news, the better off we will be in general. But I do think that if you are consuming news, aside from choosing those two or three or one topics that matter to you, you know, rather than looking at the brand, look at the individual reporters who are doing the reporting, because, you know, it's a mixed bag. It's not all the same thing. So the New York Times might have an agenda, and it might be, you know, improperly incentivized in most of its reporting. And we could see that with, for example, one of their coronavirus reporters, one of their science reporters, who was out there calling the lab leak theory racist. So that anybody wanted to consider this theory, you're just a racist. Like, she just declared it that way. But that doesn't mean that there's not other reporters who are doing great reporting or just good reporting on the same topic. So don't look at the brand, I would say. Do look at the individual reporters. Look what they're out on social media saying. Look what they're denying. Look who they are connecting to. Look who they're using as sources. And it doesn't take that much more time. It does take more mental energy. And I think that's what I mean when I say switch modalities from the lean back, kind of just like, you know, absorbing passively whatever's given to you, and lean forward, look into it. So you're reading the story anyways. Just pay a little bit more attention to who the journalist is, whose byline it is, and who are the sources in there. That tells you a lot. You know, one of the early Washington Post stories that was calling lab leak a conspiracy theory leaned on a political science reporter to speak about the validity of the scientific theory of lab leak. And you have to say to yourself, wait a second, why are they using a political scientist to speak about the validity of a scientific theory? It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And that's a red flag. And when you see a red flag like that, you know. And then you could see who is the reporter in that story. And then you can sort of just tag it in your mind as someone you do not want to rely on.
Right. Yeah, I think the era of passive consumption of all of this is over. I think we have to make that switch towards, you know, consuming things more deliberately. So Ashley, this has been a fascinating conversation, and you've written a very important book as well, very fitting for the times, and it's going to have a huge impact on all of us. Thank you again for being on Bharat Varta, and wish you all the best for everything you have coming up.
Thank you so much, Roshan. I appreciate it.
Really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you.
Me too.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Bharat Varta podcast. If you want to see more content like this, then don't forget to subscribe to our channel. We started Bharat Varta to facilitate long-form discussions on politics, policy, and culture. We don't necessarily endorse anything that was said in this episode. If you wish to offer us feedback, do reach out to us on social media. We are at Bharat Varta on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You could also get in touch with us on our website, www.bharatvarta.in. The links are in the description below. Until next time, stay safe, take care, and Jai Hind.